chair, Representative Zolkowski, Representative Fields, and myself, Rep. Slater, pro tem. Present the record reflect that we are calling to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. If you have not done so, please and thank you. Before we begin, I would like to thank Jerry Olson Edwards, the House Task Recording Secretary, and Lydia Twain from the JLIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we will continue our discussion on HB 172, Mental Health Facilities at Red Stand Governor's Office. You recall we had an executive hearing on Tuesday, March 8th, 2022, and we are continuing that conversation today. We have the number of individuals available for questions here in the room. I see we have Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor with the department this afternoon. And the rest we have on teams are on the phone. These individuals include Stephen Buckman, Senior Assistant Attorney General, the Governor of Florida, Mayor Jennifer Monroe Jackson, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, and we have Mrs. Steve Williams, CEO of the Mental Health Trust. And it looks to me we also have Renee McFarland from the Alaska Public Defender Agency, also on the line for questions. And I see you back from your name, we have yet to meet here in person as well. A quick premise before we get going, as we have a discussion today, please do keep in mind that we are setting an imminent deadline for this coming Monday, that is March 21st, at noon. I'll say that one more time, I'll say it again, lest we forget anything. Our filing is about this Monday, 21st, at noon. And before we turn back to the department with any questions that the committee has, do you have any questions for the committee members regarding process or anything you would like? Looks like, And before we open up for questions, I did want to also note that similar to how I've mentioned in the past, we'll see with two questions if that makes good sense per person and then continue in a round robin fashion. If you have additional questions, we will make sure to circle back around. And this is our first Zoom focusing business today.
Regards to the process, sometimes you're in a particular topic and it might make sense to have multiple follow-up on that one topic. So are you referring to two questions that are separate, or is it much of a series of questions just to do that and you're trying to get at?
That's my record. So if we're on a nice thread, you know, you're not to interrupt that thread so you can see the benefit of everyone involved. If I didn't have a really long line of folks, then we would like times progressing quickly and then ask you to hold that thought and give everyone else a turn. But yes, I hear you, and I think that's a reasonable request. So with that, now that we're moving forward, we can go ahead and take questions from the committee. I have Representative Zolkowski, Madam Chair. Some of the other, but we, you know, we're going to be all of this in contact, and we took the class
Stabilization center, process residential center, or evaluation center for contamination does not constitute an involuntary commitment under AS 4730 or the RF. Myself and two others respect probably don't bend deeply into the statutes. What is the difference between stabilization center in the West or involuntary
commitment? I'm the chair representing my state of the West, but I do not have a safety officer. And I just wonder if I am actually conforming edits to the law that was passed in 2020 and that's my big throw last. So, if a police officer comes across an individual who may have committed
to say that delivery to a mental health facility or a stabilization center does not necessarily show up on a court view.
Through the chair, I think that is is a better question for me to answer myself. Ms. Neal, if you would go for it. This is Nancy Lee, General Counsel for the Alaska Park System. Delivery to a crisis stabilization center would not be involved. The court will hold the file until there must still be filed something with the court. So that in itself would not be anything that appears on court view. Moreover, prevent proceedings and legal commitments and reports that are during proceedings don't appear on court view anyhow for the privacy of the individual involved.
Chair. So looking at page 6, lines 4 through 5, we're talking about the commutation period. This happened to our hold, as we're calling it. 72 hours for a particular exact amount of time, and
postponed and weakened through retiring Sundays and legal holidays from this time period. And I guess, first off, with the rational meaning that, I mean, you know, we have changes in subventions of the trade of insurance that are available 24/7. And it seems to me that something like this, that is kind of a problem with the union. But, I mean, potentially, you're talking about 3x days of travel, 72 hours.
That's kind of a the online dependency is the computation of time with how many companies do have been under 47, 30 under involuntary payments per day. The line actually changing that, and you can more specific questions on kind of why, but then, you know, how CRAs open in a practice as well, but in terms of why we keep that time, and it's also referenced on page 10, lines 4 through 7, you see where we have a mix in that. Just we're adding a new section over this residential center to see
if it's going to be for hospitalization.
We can have Mr. Bookman
back it up. Mr. Bookman. Because of the curfew deadline, it is a relatively new law. Why was it on there
last week? Mr. Bookman, can you get out there? Did you have a question? And your presentation is up on the record.
Yes, I'm on the record. I'm Stephen Bookman. And the chair, Representative Kirby, Ms. Carter is correct that the idea was to essentially change as little as possible from the current situation, that to have the same sorts of time calculations that you might for the current hospitalization system for these lower levels of care centers. In terms of why this is a good idea, it can be difficult to provide the correct kind of care without an adequate period of observation. And to the extent that there needs to be an involuntary hearing that someone doesn't go switch to be a voluntary patient, they would need there to be a high standard of evidence applied for the additional involuntary time. And in order to meet that burden, there has to be an adequate foundation for that, which really can only be accomplished by having an appropriate amount of time to evaluate the person. And it can matter in terms of staffing and in terms of timing. People can be different at night than they are during the day. And in terms of being able to staff hospitals or these facilities, that there may be different staffing patterns on evenings and weekends. As to the question about court system availability, I would defer that to Ms. Meek.
So the 72-hour evaluation period is for partially for the court system because if it doesn't handle things within moments, but it can do it 24 hours a day within reason. But as Mr. Bookman said, doctors have to evaluate a person and other things have to occur, transportation of an individual, for example. So to my knowledge, that's why the 72-hour period is covered and the exclusions are because some of those individuals are not available on the other basis and there's no orders. What program would you like to have a follow-up bring you to this question?
As a follow-up or a pivot, there's only the court will be challenged. It's potentially having the staff. I guess I'm a little concerned with convenience being the criteria for which we're going to determine that we're going to voluntarily hold somebody 72 hours or 6 days. And I think it's something we'll talk about eventually at the 6 days. Probably only in my situation for 5 days, but only the first day of the month. But if somebody can be picked up midweek and then have to be held over for the weekend, and you know, if it's a Monday holiday, and oftentimes in the state we don't observe holidays until our holiday day. There's plenty of them. So, how does that balance out with the rights of the individual who we're trying to take care of here?
Through the chair, through a representative, I can say that, and I can say with confidence, I believe that the existing laws with respect to involuntary mental commitments, the court holds the expert date, issues an expert date order typically within 24 hours. And in that expert date order, the court sets a subsequent hearing date. Nobody wants these individuals all along the way. They need to be held, especially right now when they're held in a facility that's not one of these sub-acute facilities, but typically in a hospital or in a jail. And so the court knows what day of the week it is when it issues the order. It makes every effort to have that first hearing within 72 hours. So, for example, on a Tuesday, they would not say, I have 72 hours, I'm busy until Saturday, I have to come Saturday or Sunday, so that's all we do. Rather, they would say, let's have it before the weekend so that we can get this resolved in any timely manner. And if that individual does have a public defender appointed for them who can assert that defendant's rights, if there is something they believe to be unreasonable with respect to the counting of the time period, that's helpful. Please hold your breath for a few moments here and I'll put you back in. Representative Collins.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions and they're both getting for Collins Gallagher. The first one is there was a discussion about, who's going to provide these services and how, and you said that there are about 15 or eligible providers that are potentially interested in. You want to stand up these services, which I think is great. The 115 waiver provides funding for operational expenses for actually providing the care, it doesn't provide startup costs. And, because we're talking about facilities or other places that people need to go through, sort of describing like the environment that people will go into, and they're not able to see each other by themselves. And, they don't need to raise this third cost of money, and so we have any discussion with them are very annoyed at our increased revenue projections that were just released today, that I projected an additional $1.2 million in total revenue that there may be a capital line item added to the budget to be able to pay for standing up these facilities.
Through the chair, through Ms. Reynolds, the revenue forecast just came out today. We have been having those detailed conversations, and it has been a lot of work that the department has done, which involves around the research and program technical assistance, and, to consider, other invoice needs. We haven't really had concrete budget requests or anything for them because we have been, focused on making sure we have the right mechanism in place, which, I believe, I just think that typically funds about 85% of operations, but I would be happy to defer if Steve Williams has anything to add or not.
Mr. Williams. Good afternoon, Chair, Representative Spunholz.
Mr. Williams, just for the record, if you would please put yourself on the record and then proceed.
Thank you for the reminder. Good afternoon, Steve Lyons, CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I believe Ms. Carpenter covered it well. Not only are we looking at Medicaid, but we're also looking at other additional costs associated with the setup of the facility and then the ongoing operations of the services and the revenue streams for them. And we've been working with our technical systems advisors in Arizona, as well as with local providers to be able to do that business analysis, if you will.
In a related topic, in the presentation that was done to the committee when we first heard this bill, it was identified that in the model in Georgia that was able to be addressed with the crisis call center. We're going to talk about any efforts to explore funding for the crisis call center. I need to bang my head, but we're talking about people with civil liberties and just destroying the representative contact as well as just from just a common standpoint. Being able to keep people with their home and their family and just resolve the crisis that leads them to call 911 in the first place just seems both very trauma-informed but also very, you know, cost-effective. We're going to talk a little bit about funding opportunities there or strategies that might be emerging.
Through the chair, Representative Stonewalls, as it relates to the crisis call center or the care traffic control, as it's referred to in other states, what the trust and the department are currently looking at is our current assets within Alaska that might be able to either service that function or be built out to serve that function. Currently, we have the care line. We also know that 988, the three-digit national suicide hotline number is going to be coming online. So we're looking at a variety of different options for funding that particular service type. Using our existing resources, I believe Director Rowe mentioned last week in our hearing, looking at Medicaid admin claiming. There's also the possibility of federal and other state grants, philanthropy, and other revenue streams that are being explored.
This year, $2.4 billion that year. This is a known problem, really known solution that has been, you know, being explored by the trust and the department. It's been going on now for years. It seems to me there would be, you know, a wise course for the governor to amend the budget request to include some funding for this using the narrow window money. And more certainly, it's tragic that the price of oil was forced up by the tragedy in Ukraine, but we also have this new amount of revenue that we were counting on that could help us to solve a known problem that is involved in a lot of litigation and also destroying a lot of families and local rights. I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Connell. Next, we have Representative Fields, followed by local Senator Zelensky, and then Record One.
Thanks, my previous words was rebuilding our capacity and guessing all of these nonprofits not only have the funds to just build new crisis centers, so it'd be nice to know kind of from your perspective what they're going to cost to build out and how maybe we should appropriate for it. But my question was around invalid third attention and people who may be dangerous to themselves or others, or the reason to say that we're individuals spending some time somewhere else. That library, that individual members, but that is actually within the voluntary dimension. You talk to the language in Dillon, maybe there's some assurance that people with health issues who are affected by others to others, and I see in anti-language, frankly, almost everyone who's missing other people is suffering from mental health crisis. So these are people for whom voluntary dimension is not going to work. That was the language and built strong enough to make sure that we're protecting the public from people who are dangerous, unfortunately, as a result of the health issues.
Please come up one moment, please. I just want to recognize that Representative Hardy Dade is at 338. Thank you, Ms. Bray.
Thank you. Representative Field, I'm going to ask the superintendent to share with you that you even recognize the difference between, time called and the criminal statutes and when somebody is in combat and is in trial and what happens. Versus what we're hearing in this bill, which is about civil and voluntary commitment hours. I mean, it hasn't committed a crime. That being said, there are sections of the town that have been for many moments, to the alternative to arrest. But I do think we're talking about the difference of Mr. Buckman would be better suited to answer that.
Well, I guess what I'm talking about actually is people who are disturbed and need to be involuntarily committed, but haven't committed a crime yet, and we all want to wait for them to get back before arresting them, right?
Solve the situation with
national, then they're going to be able to reach then if you go to a crisis stabilization center or a crisis residential center, which is going to be front for sure over our current option, which would be the Virginia Network Center in New York or jail. What we are trying to do and what the litigation of the Department of Justice and Fiscal Law Center is to get those individuals in crisis and here quicker so that we can solve their crisis so it doesn't keep going much higher on the level of care.
So, in reading the students, they're saying that the judgment of providers are going to be out there in the field, there is someone who they think can be a danger to themselves, or even if it's not yet to be on the ground, are they going to be able to involuntarily detain them? What is the status?
Through the chair, Virgil Williams, yes, it's only a good criteria to do so. I would say that these aren't all individuals who are committing crime. It's an individual out there looking at the law of crisis, and if they're going through the involuntary commitment crisis, and that's when infection 11 or clarifying, on which one 6-3-7, which individuals can actually then take somebody into custody so that they can let these things so they can address exactly the situation they're raising. Residential centers and stabilization centers, and in the presentation, of course, there's a whole crisis team. So, I guess what I'm looking at more really understand is who existing within our existing continuum is able to provide that referral side of it. The department had talked about pre existing DET facilities throughout the state. Technically be an expansion of services provided by existing providers. I guess I'm trying to just wrap my head around who are these people, who are these organizations and Alaskans that would be doing this work, and what kind of conversations have been had. I think about my legal community in rural Alaska, in a non-legislative environment, working in a health system. Understanding where the bright lines are of stakeholders. So I guess I'm just trying to understand that. Through the chair, Rosie Cassie and have Steve tried to, just get the provider or community at that time, we've been trying to work with to make sure there are providers that are interested and that we're supporting them in this community. And a couple of examples for our mobile crisis team, the need of behavioral health experts, we've also been able to get our department to offer them an exactly variant so they could perform the mobile crisis team engagement. In Fairbanks, the mobile crisis team, which has been operating in Rosemary's and South Florida, it's a newer nonprofit, they take now into the Fairbanks community and that's where our seed lines can clarify. I don't have a one size fits all answer because it's a little different in each community. We try to craft the objectives and definitely the legislation to really work statewide. And one thing I mentioned last week that I think worked for me
In light of the forecast and
online provider on your site to communicate with, and if you're comfortable with me, you know, sharing time from your perspective. I think we have the building blocks in place because we've been, you know, working on this and being happy and proceeding. So, I'm just hesitant because, you know, community providers, because I feel like that's the last thing that we don't want to rush anyone along. We want to make sure, you know, from providers say, hey, I want to start building up this facility, but it's going to be on a voluntary basis to make sure I have my team with me in order to have those conversations. So, I think we want to stick to the behind any provider to make sure they have the staff in place, especially when they're taking on this voluntary, you know, commitment sign of the house that they have, the providers they need, and the building and the security, all of those things. And so it's going to require, I think, a lot of conversations between the department before we, you know, can just say, yep, we're going to designate you.
I appreciate all of those considerations. Just for the benefit of the community here and for the public listening and trying to better understand the path forward. I imagine best case scenario, we're talking in terms of months, if not maybe in the year's time frame, and best case scenario for things are trying to get already to be somewhat moving.
Best case scenario, when a provider who will need it already personally, you know, mental health, so connected to here, has a building identified, and started dialing it out in 3 months, but, you know, what they do is honestly not that long, and the provider room to make sure they have everything in place, including the agency and that structure, and things out of the department. We're going to have to work hard to get human agents set up as quickly as possible so the providers can be licensed, you know, under the structure, so and actually be aware of ready reflection here. It's not necessarily the first person, so it's not that the first barrier for or this is the department getting more regulations from that. Who I know was really interested in this and we're trying to advertise this as best we can.
Thinking about allocating resources now because it takes some time for to move down the road. Thank you, I represent Carter and I represent Stan Holtz, and thank you, and then I see you back next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have two very simple questions. So the first one would be regarding parental consent. What kind of protocols do you have as bill works across maybe outside of the bill regulation that for obtaining parental consent or black and information regarding the treatment and or administering and trying to use it? That's one thing.
At the bottom of page 7, we have a section starting on 9.1 about rights of respondents, rights of representation centers, and rights of residential centers. Lines 331 talk about an adult. If you move to the top of page 8, it says the minor that you have the rights as an adult, and 4737 and 4013, so those are, you know, public statutes.
The second question, unrelated to the first, is in response to the questions being raised by Representative Small. I guess this might be for the mental health trust, but you know, I know that too, there is a, for example, a massive shortage of accessible land for development. And I had talked to one contractor, and you know, saying if the shortage of land, if the state will sell an acre building or an acre $50,000 to buy a community to build a house on it, because the demand is so much, and you can't do that because the land is available. And I know that Matt said there's thousands upon thousands of acres being held by the mental health trust that we have. When we decrease land and resources, and the mental health trust came to us to pay for most of their health needs. I guess one question in response to the line of question that Representative Small had is, would being or should this be paid for by the health care system?
Can I turn to Mr. Williams on this question?
State Williams, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, Unit Care, Representative Karka. The trust is actually actively engaged in funding many of these services that we've been talking about today to start investigations, to stand them up, to be able to provide startups cost, operating cost relief, and capital costs for some of these services in partnership with the department and other funding entities. For example, out in the MAPSU, we are working closely with the Mental Health Foundation in this effort. In regards to the trust and funding ongoing services and supports that are provided by the department and are required by constitution, where the trust money can help the department and has and is doing so currently through this effort is to be able to stand up new services and evaluate new services that could benefit Alaskans and the state, and identify those so that the state has the opportunity to assess what's working, maybe what's not working, and then be able to adapt the system and evolve the system over time, as opposed to remaining stagnant or being at risk for remaining stagnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I think you have answered the question. What I was getting at was the position that mental health has been given in terms of being able to fund these needs and the massive amount of natural resources have been given to the trust to help develop and pay those needs. It sounds like you're saying that the trust more as well than advisor when it comes to something.
With the chair, Representative Karka, that would only be a small part. We are a funder of these types of services and supports. We do use our resources, including our lands, to generate revenue that is either invested as part of the principal or purpose of the trust, or is used as spendable income that can be used for grant funding either through the state system or directly out to the community nonprofits, tribal health entities, local governments. We grant every year, on average, grant out about $20 to $25 million a year to a variety of programs and services in our communities around the state that serve trust beneficiaries.
Next, we have Representative Scott. Trust resources are not designed to be used for ongoing needs, but instead for capacity building processes. Have you done capital grants in the past? At this time, if we were, I think what the purpose of the grant is, it's maybe a twofold question, and I'll let also the study the land issue specifically, because I think that's a separate issue. And there's the trust only involves those that are responsible to manage those for financial benefit for them to fund the trust work. But you'll talk about the trust resources and the way those are used and whether or not capital, the cost will be left on capital investments.
Steve Williams, CEO for the trust, Trinity Chair Representative Stonewalls, yes, the trust does provide funding for capital projects. For example, we helped several years ago stand up the Sober and Steiner out in Bethel, and we invested capital dollars in that. We provided capital funding to set free up in the Napsu Valley to stand up some of their newer facilities, not only in the valley, but when they expanded down into services being provided in Homer. So we absolutely do fund capital projects.
Just based on a current discussion that was in the first earlier, I want to point out that this discussion today has largely been focused on the jails place on hold and residential facilities and detention centers people who experience mental health crises are not, by definition, abnormal to truly implement. I think that when we're having these conversations, I want to be really clear about that. That even have, you know, a mental health crisis at any stage in your life, like psychosis, for example, is a symptom of, you know, and a severe urinary tract infection, for example. There are many reasons why people can have an acute psychiatric episode. I mean, these people are our mothers or fathers, or our sisters or brothers, or something, our daughters, and we need to always be talking about them with respect when we're having these conversations. But again, I just realized, you know, with these in our language, I just want to be really clear about that. It's really important that we think about that, and that's one of the reasons that I'm so keen on focusing energy upstream in the crisis now conversation, and not just focusing in on the residential and stabilization energy drug burden for anyone for a spectrum of services, but the reason why we need to make sure we get those crisis call centers online as soon as possible is if I need to call, you know, if I need to call somebody to get help from my mother or father, I don't want to have to be APD. I want to be somebody who can help connect their resources so I can be a good dog and caregiver for my family, for my loved one, you know. That's the reason why we need funding for mobile, you know, mobile crisis teams, because we want to make sure that when families are experiencing a crisis, they can get the help that they need, the more they need, and not wait for it to get so serious that we have to be thinking about it over a 7 month. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Cox.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to circle around to the 72-hour hold that we were talking about a few minutes ago. I hadn't really thought about it before, but other than 72 hours, or if it was an extended period of time, there's the person in the facility, and there might be others upon whom they depend upon them, specifically children. Discuss that. How's that work, please? On the ground, if someone is detained and they might have dependents, how do you know that?
So, Senator Fox, that would be, you know, if somebody is saying to a typical life with a child, they would utilize their existing laws, you know, looking.
Question I have is,
cognitive care, and I've brought up in this time here, what is being done to have an electronic health record type format that the providers will have from the beginning of the 24-hour hold or time there to the time that they are going out the door to a provider someone to do the cognitive care elsewhere. What is being done to have a system in place that all players, providers that are involved can tie into that system, and that person that perhaps maybe someone that's needing treatment and help or whatever, and that cognitive care EHR system levels that we know that they have a child. That level there to mitigate that while they're being helped in whatever stage they're in. So, what's being done for that system?
That's a good question. Electronic health records, you know, we can take a lot of different avenues. So, the state does have our health information exchange, which we're continually trying to improve and, you know, enroll new providers into using. But as you know, we're not every provider would use the same thing in general, or use, you know, the state's PTI. We're looking at that avenue. A lot of our things that are around the community and other resources. And some years ago, the Hospital Association worked with the department to assign a 74 ICDF kind of IT system where, you know, the emergency room are connected in the same database and they can kind of get those notifications. So we know if a patient's been in frequent flyers and, you know, finds out to the valley, et cetera, why do we need to help? It's because API is finally connected to that system. So that way, if, you know, somebody gets discharged from EPI and they, you know, go into province and the rest is calling to not pull up and see what, you know, treatment you're receiving in terms of meds. I think it is a conversation that is a little bit executive as well, but it's an important conversation. However, pushing forward health information technology exchange because, you know, we still have some providers who may only do records on paper. Again, it's a little bit of a technical scope. I'm happy to go down that road. I don't do any others going to.
Actually, thank you, Chair. I'd like to stay on this rabbit trail. That's the spider rabbit trail. It's a good way. And I went down to Phoenix and I saw the program that they had done there. And the heartbeat of the program is an effective communication system and the EHR system that's there. And that's what impressed me the most. Is that the provider, they have their own system, but all those providers also were linked into this collective system. And I've seen this happen, I've seen a number of different, you know, programs being set up for years, which is great, but I'm very, very concerned. And I want to be family aids. And have to have a system that all providers, as they become a recognized provider, have access into this collective database, the EHR system, so we can help people. And there's not a drop in cognitive care. The thing that I saw that was very impressive is that person that picked up on the street, that all the information that person, if they were in the system, was at the crisis center before they even arrived. And the transfer was saved in only 2 minutes from the, you know, because they already had a list of, if you don't have that, we still fully count this.
Through the chair, Brad McCarty, you know, I do whatever we do, it's important to think about how we can be connected in terms of, you know, health information exchange. You know, that might bring forward some different policy calls about this idea that, you know, we need to consider, you know, health information exchanges in general. The department, you know, has taken the position of trying to encourage providers to, you know, move to electronic records, sign up for the HIV if you really desire to do so. We've had some program in our, the commissioner's office. towards people and then taking the power with you. You don't have your own ongoing tests or something. Actually, the trust of the companies, helping your health providers and the insurance that they can have them. And we're also going to be having a lot of electronic health records. But, you know, we have been hesitant to consider mandating one size fits all HIV, even though the state wants to have the data, and not every provider wants to use that exact system. Plus, we don't think tribal consumer has very robust, you know, electronic health records. It has been very fully thinking through some of that. So I think those are more detailed conversations, but it's not very important. I have a parallel with the former chief on this bill, but I would have to bring in my tap on the groups who work on these projects to answer more than women. Robert, I'll let you follow up with Robin to do that.
Talking about this with the Department of Behavioral Health, DHHS, for over 20 years, and the fact that the population, the threat can be returned, or the system, the system to get the information necessary. It's the problem that exists in the state now. You have to have one employee that's entering data into this, to the HR or whatever it be, and then have to go into the same thing for the state system. We do have the technology, and there's providers out there that didn't have their own EHR system, and we don't want to take that away, but it can propagate off to this collective database. And I think this is a great model for looking at that whole new paradigm. I think this is a paradigm filled out that is missing an important leg. The question is, how do you balance, I guess, the patient's right to privacy with any change of information? How do you get consent for that, and how does that work?
So, consider, Representative Kirkland, that would be covered by HIPAA. And, you know, patients would have to sign, like, when you have a hospital, some disclosures and then HIPAA. Just be scared without following down on that before it's over.
So I guess a follow-up here would be, can I make sense? I get that. But what's the mental health care? I can't remember where the wife was. We're trying to have a hunger for delivery. They're second born. And he was very keen, so we had to go to the hospital the last minute. And my wife was just in transition while they're being here signing all kinds of documents, which that's arguable if this is governmental before, but whatever. If someone's in the middle of a mental health crisis, how do they give informed consent or something like this? Because we're talking about the wellness about the acute mental health crisis, which is taken to a facility or picked up because there's a crisis or not in the right mind.
Yes, Mr. Butler.
address the issues where someone who does not have the power to consent for whatever reason, whether they're unconscious or whether they're simply unable to sort of grasp that kind of concept at the time, and subject to the limiting principle that the minimum amount necessary of information be exchanged, providers are able to exchange information for treatment purposes, for example.
Again, I'm trying to think, I'd like to look at that protocol, but I'm trying to think. I get there has to be a balance. You know, if somebody is in a crisis, I'm trying to think of how you balance my personal rights. I'd like to say I'm happy to do that. People have a lot of concern these days with their privacy being almost non-existent.
Thank you, Ed. Next, I have Representative Sponholz, followed by Representative Brooks. Okay, thanks for that, Sponholz. Brooks, you're up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Last year, almost a third of the Nazi race and concerns. There's race concerns about the involuntary medications in the way. How does this, or does this bill change involuntary medications and how can people be assured that its rights are being protected to the extent that they can versus the people who are ability to be protected, etc.?
Thank you, General. That's a great question. I'm going to answer that in two parts. So, first part, the current version of the bill that you have in front of you makes no changes to the crisis medication statute. So, what it does authorize is that a current provider who can prescribe and administer these meds, which is a physician's assistant or an advanced health practitioner, can also do this in a crisis situation in a crisis stabilization center. Our crisis prevention center. So our goal is to provide the same tools and use meeting centers as we currently have at St. ETF for Walmart DTs. What I referenced to General Kresge's question earlier about the letter that you got from provider number 7, he's on page 2 of his letter, he talks about corporate administration of medication, which is in AS 473. He suggested some amendments that would fix statutes that were declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. This is the one that I mentioned. We went back and forth with Mr. Beckman on some language amendments that I wanted to streaming, but he wanted that just to include more drafting, choices and communication, any benefits of drafting, he would have some spend if not we rejected that. So my intention is to provide all of those edits in full, that's to the people to have the community's consideration.
Because in fact, I have that noted and we'll make sure we can submit that to the committee.
Well, I think that we could just take a wait for that to see what the changes might actually be. So.
And it would be very helpful, as you heard me say at the beginning, we have a community amendment deadline by Monday night at noon. It would be very helpful to the committee members if they could see the work that you're doing in collaboration with Mr. Bassett, ahead of that deadline so they can address it accordingly. Thank you. I have United States Representative Porta, and it looks like Representative Purdy.
Just to clarify, the last one was great community amendment. Sure, that was it. Those were changes that were worked out in this draft, or are you working on changes now that we're going to see the results of?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Portman, I won't be offended if you're on my half listening. Late afternoon, those are changes that are not considered in the current draft. The department has been working on doing this for us in the as we vote.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We have Representative Curry.
Thank you. Chair Sally, you mentioned about amendment at noon of Monday.
Yes.
So can that be pushed to like 4
Monday instead, just because we have some lengthy discussions in a certain process. And we don't get this till later, I'm not concerned about.
Thank you.
to give quick eddies. We have set the internet deadline for noon on March 21. We make some of our time as Carpenter for helping us be able to meet that deadline in an informed fashion. So we will continue to hear this bill over the next few hearings and to hear amendments. We will be doing primary public testimony on Thursday, so that is coming up ahead this week. And with that, I will say the next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be on Thursday, March 17th at 3 p.m. in Davis 106 this room. And additionally, to highlight, we are also returning back, in addition to hearing public testimony on 172, we have HB 292, Home and Community Services, as a bill that I am carrying. And as a final reminder, the deadline was extended on that bill to tomorrow.